Gwini cor ar y wtron, Cynhwysyn Hilsgyliau, blo clir. Is yma i'r coli ac i jo, to ffyr cyn ohys ar fe'n sialiad, agos cynnan symposium tofoch tog sio, fwy'n tredil Feeding the World yn gofil sy'n cwegia, a osgol gyhyffygwr. So i ddw sboer y bywoliom yn lagd egr hyn sio, sy'n institut bu y slan sio sy'n cynhwysyn, a fola fwy'n y fe'n y nos doctor'n grŵp y synwliau a lefel sio. Agos tam cyn sy'n gysbregu sy'n moron plei yr un tîn y ffyr hofoch tog sio sy'n dol o eto rwy'n. President and former colleague Joe and dear friends, it's a great pleasure to be here. I've just been speaking in our own language, which is our native language, in Irish, because it is part of my policy as president to use this language every day. I'm very pleased to be here to open this policy symposium on the great title of Feeding the World in 2050. So may I, at the outset, begin by congratulating the organisers here at University College Dublin, the Institute for Food and Health, for hosting such a high-level group of experts who will be discussing this very important theme over the next 2 days. I read with great interest the titles of the 9 papers you will hear, and they are addressing very different aspects of what is what I will call the greatest moral problem facing us all. I am pleased to note that this symposium is an official event of the Irish Presidency of the European Union, and that the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine and the Food Safety Authority of Ireland are co-sponsoring. This event will be followed by another event during the Irish Presidency of the European Union, an event in April under the title Hunger, Nutrition and Climate Justice, which will facilitate a dialogue between key policymakers, global leaders, local people and practitioners facing the realities of rising food prices, failed crops, and undernutrition. Both of these events are important in defining the Irish presidency of the European Union as a presidency that will use its term to further plan the route for long-term sustainable solutions to issues such as hunger, an achievement which would be an important achievement for any presidency of the European Union. The title of your conference, Feeding the World in 2050, sets out what I believe to be one of the most serious challenges facing the global community. Today, chronic hunger affects 1 in 7, or approximately 925 million of the world's 6.8 billion people every day. The principal source of hunger is the dire poverty exacerbated by gross inequalities that scandalously persist. Eradicating this poverty and its consequences is, I suggest, the greatest moral and ethical challenge we as a global community face today. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, the numbers of those experiencing hunger is on the increase for 3 reasons. Neglect of such agriculture as is relevant to very poor people by governments and international agencies. Secondly, the current worldwide economic crisis. And thirdly, the significant increase of food prices in the last several years, which has been devastating to those with only a dollar or a few dollars to spend. Nearly all of those who are hungry are in developing countries. Furthermore, the FAO estimates that world food production will need to increase by 60% by 2050 to meet the needs of the projected world population of 9 billion people. This increase would be difficult in its own right without additional threats. Such additional threats, notably from climate change. And again, the response to what is needed in increased food production must acknowledge not only the science and technology transfers that are needed to increase production, but also the patterns of land holding, the vulnerability of those who work the soil, and particularly the gender issues that arise. The science, as reported by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and International Food Policy Research Institute, predicts that the overall impact of climate change will see an increase in extreme weather events, such as droughts and floods, in vulnerable parts of the world, including Africa and Asia. The impact of these circumstances on food security will see agriculture systems that are already vulnerable to change exposed to lower yields, thus pushing vast number of already poor people deeper into poverty and hunger. In Asia alone, projected declines in crop yields such as rice and wheat threaten the food security of over 1.6 billion people. In Africa, decreased food availability will lead to fewer calories consumed per person, thus increasing malnourishment in children. Potentially 52 million children in sub-Saharan Africa will experience malnutrition by 2050. In responding to the challenge of climate change and the need to ensure that we promote sustainable, environmentally sound agricultural growth, a number of other issues need to be confronted if we are to stand in solidarity with the world's poor and ensure that they have access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food. These include recognizing the impact of rising oil prices, which will drive the use of land and crops towards biofuels, with serious implications for global food production. And I am pleased to see that you will address this issue directly as part of your symposium. It is also essential that appropriate prominence be given to the gender aspect of development policies and projects, so as to ensure that women's rights in the agricultural sector in developing countries are sufficiently recognized and strengthened. In terms of agricultural productivity, for instance, we must ensure equal access to productive resources for women who represent the majority of smallholder farmers in developing countries. Control of resources such as land and credit is vital. We know that although women may formally have access to a resource, in reality, they might not have a role in decision-making on how that resource is used. Other measures that must be prioritized in this regard are facilitating women's access to agricultural extension services, supporting cooperatives with female involvement at all levels, promoting the adoption of appropriate inputs and technology to free up women's time for income-producing activities and support for women's entrepreneurship. The Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that the undernourishment in developing countries could be lowered by between 12 and 17% if the gap between men and women in access to inputs was eliminated. Again, some prescriptions from international institutions take little account of production realities on the ground. The advocates of the De Soto model, for example, on land tenure, which suggests using land as collateral for private bank loans, has been and will continue to be a model that contains significant dangers for dispossession of women farmers in the fields. The Irish public, perhaps due to historical experience of famine, responds generously to appeals for famine relief. In comparison to every other country, the gap is enormous. Agus ceandas na tráchtaíochtaí súlánaí d'Arlín is seo, gur féidirlín iarfort an gcorta bhreá i bhfiarám agus go gcrítear sin chun a trádála ach ag an am céine ní aithnimid cuid an orfírinn. It is one of the most challenging contradictions of our times that while the impact of famine can in real time be brought to our consciousness by the new technologies of the media and thus move us to a compassionate response, yet at the same time we fail to acknowledge some macroeconomic and world economic realities that seek to exploit famine, food shortages, and climate change for exploitative profits. I note that in this afternoon's session, chaired by a predecessor of mine as President of Ireland, former President Mary Robinson, you will be discussing the effects of finance and market speculation on food security. This is a crucial issue. There is a conflict between the speculative culture of recent decades and our better ethical impulse. If I might give an example, all of us as concerned publics may recognize the consequences of drought, yet for some others, such food shortages simply afford an opportunity for short-term gain. As Professor Howard Stein of the University of Michigan puts it, commodity markets are being driven not by fundamentals of producers and end users, but by other factors. Among other things, commodities are seen as a good hedge when the value of the dollar falls, which lowers the value of global commodities in non-dollar terms. Strategies now include speculation on food, which has become a biosubstitute for fuels, with frightening implications to the welfare of millions of net food buyers in poor developing countries. In 2011, for example, it is estimated that 61% of the wheat futures market was held by speculators, compared to 12% in the mid-90s prior to deregulation. And Professor Stein continued, the amount of money flowing to speculation in food markets, futures, continues to grow appreciably, and it roughly doubled between 2006 and 2011. The result was a steep rise in food prices, which more than doubled between June 2003 and June 2008. After declining following the financial crisis, they started rising and peaked in April 2011 at more than 2.5 times the deregulation level of June 1999. The impact on food consumers in poor African countries is well documented. The International Monetary Fund estimates that on average, the internal price of food rises by 0.33% for every 1% in global food prices. A survey of 58 developing countries, food prices were up by 56% between 2007 and 2010, putting millions more at risk of undernourishment and malnutrition. This new environment of high and volatile food prices calls for urgent measures to protect the food security of the world's poorest food consumers. The international community through the G20 has agreed, I know, to an agricultural markets information system to provide transparency in key commodity markets. But this is just one small practical measure that can limit speculation and provide information for farmers about potential choices in the short term. But the bigger issues that have been noted and as I have quoted by Professor Stein remain. The right to food itself, of course, has been addressed in international legal discourse. It is perhaps appropriate to recall the international legal obligations that fall on Ireland and other countries who share both the security but also the obligations of the United Nations. Ireland is a signatory to a number of human rights agreements that oblige us to take action to realize the right to food. These include Article 25 of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights on the right to a standard of living, Article 11 of the 1966 International Convention on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, at the Rome Declaration on World Food Security in 1996, Ireland joined other nations in reaffirming its commitment to ensure the right to food is realized at global level. Thus, one can understand very easily why Ireland has given prominence to this issue during the presidency of the European Union. Subsequent to the Rome Declaration, the United Nations Economic and Social Council produced General Comment 12 on the right to adequate food in 1999. The comment elaborates language detailing the necessary steps to be taken by states and civil society to respect, protect, facilitate, and fulfill the right to food. It clarifies state, civil society, and community obligations to work together to enable the right to food to be realized. When every man, woman, and child, alone or in community with others, has physical and economic access at all times to adequate food or means for its procurement. The types of obligations defined in General Comment 12 were endorsed by states when the FAO Council adopted the Right to Food guidelines in November 2004. The obligation to respect requires governments not to take any measures that arbitrarily deprive people of their right to food, for example, by measures preventing people from having access to food. The obligation to protect means that states should enforce appropriate laws and take other relevant measures to prevent third parties, including individuals and corporations, from violating the right to food of others. The obligation to fulfill, facilitate, and provide entails that governments must proactively engage in activities intended to strengthen people's access to and utilization of resources so as to facilitate their ability to feed themselves. As a last resort, whenever an individual or group is unable to enjoy the right to food, to adequate food, for reasons beyond their control, states have the obligation to fulfill that right directly. These voluntary guidelines represent a first attempt by governments to interpret an economic, social, and cultural right and to recommend actions to be undertaken for its realization. The objective of the voluntary guidelines is to provide practical guidance to states in their implementation of the program, progressive realization of the right to adequate food in the context of national food security. A comprehensive definition of food security requires the special nutritional requirements of those most vulnerable groups to be taken into account when planning for food production, distribution, and utilization. This calls for improved linkages between agriculture and health sectors to cover the three pillars of food security: availability, physical supply, accessibility to acquire food, and utilization, the capacity to transform food into the desired nutritional outcomes. At the global level, it is clear that a consensus is increasingly emerging among concerned scholars like yourselves and practitioners, which stresses the need for an integrated and comprehensive approach to addressing food security and the right to food through linking agriculture, food security, and nutrition interventions. Moreover, international initiatives, such as the Rome Principles for Sustainable Global Food Security, the Comprehensive Agriculture Development Programme, and the Comprehensive Framework for Action, would seem to indicate that resource mobilisation, a favourable policy environment, and political leadership are possible and could be on the horizon with appropriate advocacy by civil society, state actors, and a renewed commitment by international agencies who have a mixed history. Ireland, in its global advocacy on hunger, has consistently promoted the need to address the multi-sectoral causes of undernutrition and the need to realign our development response to link agriculture, health, nutrition, and social protection interventions more closely to achieve improved nutrition outcomes. Irish Aid, in launching the Hunger Task Force, in the appointment of a special envoy for hunger, and in the facilitation of the Dublin Dialogue on the Comprehensive Framework for Action for the United Nations High-Level Task Force on Hunger in 2010, has not only demonstrated a firm commitment to tackling global hunger, but has shown a willingness to play a lead role in the international response. At global level, Ireland has given leadership on hunger and undernutrition. In 2010, Ireland and the United States of America led the 1,000 Days of Action to scale up nutrition, which focused on mothers and baby health in the crucial early days of life through pregnancy to the age of two. The wider Scaling Up Nutrition movement followed, and in 2012, Ireland honoured its self-imposed commitment to spend 20% of its overseas aid budget on hunger prevention, demonstrating its commitment to leading the fight against hunger. Nevertheless, despite the growing recognition of the need to consider nutrition as part of any comprehensive response to food security, Food security programmes all too often overlooked or neglect nutrition. Indeed, nutrition has been described by the Hunger Task Force as an administrative and institutional orphan, despite growing acceptance that undernutrition makes a multifaceted contribution to simultaneously meeting several of the Millennium Development Goals, including maternal health, child mortality, and education. While many developing countries seek, need, and welcome investment at the present time in relation to food production, there is clear evidence of some powerful states putting a version of food security that serves their national interest ahead of international responsibility to the hungry of the world. Some states and corporations are taking over agricultural land in developing countries to secure their own food security, or indeed to boost corporate speculative profits at the expense of the developing world. Despite the often widespread popular opposition to such proposals and the invariably weak governance environment in which the schemes are to be implemented, the support of the international community, if quietly voiced and not unqualified, has encouraged the spread of the phenomenon. The grab for land and drive for profits are so obviously contributing to evictions, poverty, and conflict. Some agri-corporations have acquired the power to undermine national regulatory agencies that often are forced or induced to accept the claims and motives of the corporations involved at face value. Such corporations seek to open up markets for profits, and the subsequent changes have tended to favor large-scale producers and global agribusinesses, frequently at the expense of local producers who grow food for local markets, thus compounding problems of inequitable land ownership. Balancing the increase in food provision and an appropriate humanitarian response that is culturally contingent is indeed complex and is a clear area for interdisciplinary cooperation in both analysis and project management. Farmers in the developed world receive substantial subsidies to produce food, which may be subsequently delivered to developing countries in the form of cheaper free food, and often in a manner that can dramatically undercut the ability of indigenous farmers to make a living, as well as leading to an increased dependency upon foreign food aid among the receiving communities. States and international organizations should consider the benefits of such local procurement for food assistance, as could integrate the nutritional needs of those affected by food insecurity and the commercial interests of local producers. The large portion of the assistance of the World Food Programme, the largest and most widespread implementer of food assistance projects in the world, remains United States-provided food in kind assistance. Although new initiatives, such as Purchase for Progress, which enables low-income farmers to supply food to the World Food Programme's operations, indicates a welcome recognition of the need to shift away from what many in the development community describe as food dumping, a practice they see as remaining quite widespread at present. In relation to, finally, Marfuckle Square, to conclude, in relation to a just trading regime, it is important to recognize that one size doesn't fit all. Trade rules that ignore the point of development of developing countries often force some poor countries to open their economies to goods from rich countries in the name of liberalization. But poor countries' farmers and industries are sometimes forced to adopt an imposed liberalization before they are ready to compete. Decades of forced liberalization has devastated many poor countries, resulting in huge job losses, poor health care, and less education. Trade liberalization often comes alongside increased rights for foreign investors and pressure to privatize its economy, including replacing state credit systems by private banking, an essential feature of the De Soto model. Jan Ziegler, former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the right to food between 2000 and 2008, was very forthright when he spoke to journalists in 2004. Today, agricultural trade is far from being free, and even further from being fair. Market forces could not stop hunger, and the organization's 146 member states should place the emphasis on food sovereignty. A country could, for example, not only reject measures for liberalization, but also introduce protectionist tariffs for a particular agricultural product. Another group of smaller countries that included Japan, Norway, Switzerland, and South Korea wanted to keep some barriers to market access for farm products to preserve small-scale vulnerable farming communities. Ziegler admitted on the sidelines of the annual meeting of the United Nations Human Rights Commission that his ideas clash head-on, and I quote him, break the logic of the World Trade Organization. Poor peasant farmers account for 3/4 of the 1.2 billion of the poorest people. And he said, I quote, they should be able to feed themselves in dignity, Ziegler stated in his report to the Commission. Models of export-oriented agriculture that threaten the livelihoods of millions of peasant farmers should be reviewed, his report said, criticizing the dominance of food and agricultural multinationals in world trade. The report estimated that 840 million people were undernourished, even though production was enough to feed the whole of the world's population. I conclude by saying this. I so want to wish your conference well. I congratulate the university for organizing this, and particularly for its interdisciplinary thrust. Ziegler's report said in its day, hunger is neither inevitable nor should it be acceptable. It is a daily massacre and a shame on humanity, his report concluded. Tom Duhan and Ishni Snow Maravi Sharif, Margot Kusul Gamek Dendrondane, Matio Osquimsha, Ithan Inishakas Govilas Quake, Agasni Mordu and Torkton Via Vedu Darer, Conriotness and Fabula Hosse. The challenges facing us all now are greater than ever, as the world's population looks to expand rapidly by 2050, and food production must increase to meet their needs. I am pleased that Ireland's European Union presidency is reflecting the political imperative to place hunger at the centre of our efforts, both now and in the years after 2015, when the Millennium Development Goals set at the beginning of the century will be succeeded by new targets. I want to wish all of you, and particularly those of you who have come from abroad, all the success that you deserve from your commitment and scholarship. Garamila Mahage, agus fógraim gwilan, cógal oscailte go hifigur. I declare your conference open. Thank you very much.